The circus was the most popular form of entertainment in America 100 years ago, and the circus sideshow was a huge draw. People would save their pennies to come to see the bearded lady and the tall man and the conjoined twins. Author Beth Macy dug deep into the world of sideshows in her book True Vine, Two Brothers, a Kidnapping, and a Mother's Quest, a true story of the Jim Crow South. It tells the story of George and Willie Muse, two boys who were pulled into the circus in 1899 and spent most of their lives as sideshow attractions. Earlier this year, the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus shut down, in part because of concerns over the welfare of elephants and other animal performers. In the days Macy wrote about, humans were the ones exploited.
Ringling Brothers, when they closed, cited animal rights activism as one of the reasons that made them not so successful anymore. But back long before we worried about people exploiting animals, I mean, they were exploiting people in the sideshow, and chief among them were African Americans, people with disabilities, people thought to be fodder for people's entertainment to look at.
Could you read a little bit from the book?
Sure.
And maybe set it up for us, Beth.
Okay. So in this section, I'm describing the way the trains would roll into town. They said that the circus was like a moving city at night. They would pack up at the end of a show, and then they would go on to the next venue. And when they would wake up, it would be dawn. And people would come out. People who couldn't afford a ticket for the circus, they were called the lot lice. They would set their alarms to be there at 6 in the morning when the circus would unload. Because if you couldn't afford a ticket, you could at least for free see all the acts as they were coming off the trains, like just dozens and dozens of train cars. So I'm trying to describe how the sideshow fit into this. I say, picture a single car, usually somewhere near the front of the train, full of human misfits, a bearded lady, a skeleton man, a conjoined twin complaining that she hadn't slept because her sister was tossing and turning all night. The freaks, people called them, in politically incorrect language that fit right in with other offensive circus lingo, which was fine by most of the freaks because, well, they had their own pride of calling, too. As the art photographer Diane Arbus once said of sideshow performers, quote, most people go through life dreading they'll have a traumatic experience. Freaks were born with their trauma. They've passed their test in life. They're aristocrats.
There was a certain kind of act they were looking for, a certain kind of person, and you go into this saying that the circus operators wanted to make sure somebody wasn't totally pitiable, but that they had an obvious difference from the quote-unquote normal person, and that they could do something that was to be admired, some kind of talent.
They had to have a talent. They had to be different and unusual to look at, not something you would see just every day in your daily lives. They had to be not offensive. So the fat lady had to be curvaceous, but still really pretty in the face. And a family of dwarves that could also sing. That was the other thing they wanted. They wanted people to have a skill so that when you came into the sideshow tent, the lecturer would take you by every act and introduce them. Then they would either answer questions about their disability, or they would perform. So there was a man who could put like 38 little ping pong balls in his mouth. Somebody else could blow smoke out of his eyes. They would present their skill.
And the person giving the spiel, the lecturer, would also, I mean, make things up out of whole cloth about where people came from. And this is what I want you to talk about right now. The two people who were at the center of the story that you wrote, a sideshow act made up of two African-Americans, Willie and George Muse. They were from a place called Truvine in Virginia. They were in a family of sharecroppers. They were African-American, but they had another visible difference.
Right. They had albinism. And so that meant that they were legally blind at birth, and they have very light skin, but otherwise they had African-American features. And what the circus did is they exaggerated their features. So they had them grow their hair out long, and they put them into dreadlocks before anybody knew what dreadlocks were. So they sort of exploded. The dreadlocks were sort of gathered at the crown of their head, and they sort of exploded like fireworks, and dressed them in really kind of exotic costumes that matched whatever name they were calling them by at the time. So their most common name was Eco and Ico, ambassadors from Mars, and they were said to have been discovered coming out of a wrecked spaceship in the Mojave Desert.
When in actuality it was several miles away on a farm that they may have been taken from or lured away from when they were working outside in the field, or the way other stories go, their mother may have actually contracted or leased them to the circus for a certain amount of time.
Initially, yes. And if that's the case, and it was never anything I could quite pin down, but there is some likelihood that perhaps she initially let them go. She was expecting them to be returned, and then we know that they were trafficked unpaid for a period of at least 13 years.
Unpaid?
Unpaid.
They didn't get any money. They could send no money home.
They were told their mother was dead and to quit asking to go home and to quit crying. And so when she finally files a lawsuit to get justice for her family after she gets them back, she's able to prove that they've been unpaid for a period of at least the last 7 years that they've been with Ringling Brothers at the time. So she wins a settlement.
And that is an amazing part of the story, just that this African-American woman who's exceedingly poor, didn't have a lot of resources, was able to get these two back. Hold that thought, because I want to get back to exactly what life was like for these participants in the sideshow. We say participants, but really they didn't have much choice at that point.
I don't think they were all pulled in against their will. The thing is about, you never know whether to believe the accounts because there is so much tricksterism and fakery. And sometimes the sideshow bands were usually made up of African-American performers, many of them from New Orleans. And to pick up extra money, they would take side gigs pretending to be savages that had been discovered from an African country. And they called this is, I'm going to go get my Zulu ticket this summer, my side job, pretending to be somebody discovered in the wilds of Africa. One of the things that people in the sideshow would always say was that people were laughing at us in the audience, but we were laughing at them backstage because they were paying money to see us. So in almost every account that you read, and even from people who I talked to that were in sideshows, there was this pride of calling, too, that they made a pretty good living. They weren't institutionalized. And those who were treated with respect were kind of proud of the work that they did. And once the Muse brothers were able to be paid, they actually got to experience a lot that they might not have if they had stayed home in Roanoke, Virginia, where they lived in abject poverty, where their family lived in abject poverty.
It's one of the fascinating things about this whole story that eventually, you know, when their mother, when George and Willie's mother was able to get them out of the circus, they lived in very cramped quarters. They at one point would work for money by singing in a window of a local drugstore. They were good musicians, right?
They were good musicians, but one gentleman who was still alive when I was reporting on this book, he no longer is, he said they looked really sad to him. And they actually realized they were more comfortable with the sideshow people than they were at home, especially once they knew their mother was alive and they could come home to visit her in the off season. And they were contributing to their family's economy.
And so they really did buy in at that point, and they liked having an audience.
You know, it's great to be good at something, and it makes you feel good to be good at what you do. And I think the music gave them just untold amounts of joy. At the end of his life, Willie lived to be 108. He was still singing the songs he had learned during the 19-teens, little pop songs from the 19-teens and 20s.
You know, it's so easy to be revolted by the very concept of a sideshow and the kind of exploitation that was built in. But as you discovered in the story of George and Willie Muse, it wasn't entirely bad for the people who were in it. But what transpired to make it unpopular, the sideshow unpopular, and kind of a mirror of what's happened with animal acts in the circus today?
Exactly. I mean, you're right. We're almost revolted to hear about such things today. So they retire in the early 1960s, and because of how their mother had advocated, they had basically a house bought and paid for in their names. And they end up retiring at the same time in history that we start caring about disability rights, and the sideshow slowly fades away. And so their careers very much mirror the last 50 years of the sideshow. I mean, it was kind of at its peak when they first got going, and then by the time they retire, it's going away.
I'd like to end with a piece of music that you were able to get from Willie Muse's great niece. Her name is Nancy Saunders.
Yes.
And she gave this to you and set it up for us.
Sure. So this is a song that George and Willie learned in the mid-teens when they were first on the road. It was a World War I anthem about missing home. And Willie used to say when he was sad at night, crying, missing his mother, they would sing this song and his brother would tell him, "Don't worry, I know she's alive. I know we're going to see her one day." And so at the end of his life, when he's 108 and he's totally blind by this point, he has a picture of his mother up next to his bed and he straightens it every night, even though he can no longer see it. And he's still singing this song that meant so much to him, that harken back to this idea that we will be okay and we will see our mother again. And so Nancy got him to record it around when he was about 102 or 3.
This is the late 1990s.
Yeah, wow. He didn't die until 2001.
We'll play it now. Beth Macy, author of True Vine, thank you so much.
Thanks, Lisa.
It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, my Piccalilli, farewell, Oyster Square. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there.